KaiserNetwork.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Peter Bakker, Carol Jacobs, Jonathan Oppenheimer, and Michael White. And our moderator once again, Michelle Norris.
I had a chance to talk to this panel in the hallway, and they have good energy, so I think we're in for a lot of fun. Let everyone get settled for just a minute and close the doors out there so we can actually hear each other. In this section of our discussion, we're going to talk about making the business case for global health. Now, clearly, the vast array of health challenges confronting the world cannot be addressed by governments and NGOs alone. The corporate community, from multinationals to micro-enterprises, has a critical role to play, and a critical role for three major reasons. First, unhealthy people are productive workers. Each malaria episode costs an equivalent of 10 working days. The 300 to 500 million such episodes, I'm just going to say that again, 300 to 500 million such episodes that occur each year cost businesses billions of dollars in lost productivity. 18 countries in sub-Saharan Africa are projected to have workforces 10 to 30% smaller because of HIV and AIDS by the year 2020. When business invests in health for its workforce and supply chain partners, it contributes to high productivity and economic success that is great for the company and it's good for its workforce. Second, a healthy population promotes economic predictability. Since their employees are intertwined with their communities, poor health contributes to weak local economies and diminished economic sustainability. For example, the unchecked spread of HIV and AIDS in India alone could slow its GDP by nearly one percentage point. One percentage point. Now that sounds small, but that one percentage point translates into billions, with a B, billions of dollars. Now, third, when businesses get involved in promoting and maintaining global health, it contributes to security. HIV and AIDS has become widely viewed as a national security risk. Now, partly due to its potential impact on soldiers and peacekeepers, but also, when things happen in one country, it has a great effect beyond those borders. When something happens, a local outbreak occurs, you see an immediate effect in a local marketplace, but it's almost like a force multiplier. It grows and expands with each country and promotes and prevents economic transactions that then you see this problem grow and grow and expand. The goal of this session is to explore why businesses should be engaged in global health, to recognize the challenges that businesses face in doing so, and to identify opportunities, new opportunities. And for this discussion, we have a wonderful panel here, and as I say, they have good energy, and one of them has already asked if it's okay to undress. Now, if by that you meant, can you take off your jacket? Yes, that is okay. It is warm up here under the lights, so if anyone wants to, we came to roll up our sleeves, so you can't do that with your jacket on, so good for you. I'm going to start at the end there. Mike White is the vice chair of PepsiCo, and he's chairman and CEO of PepsiCo International. He's been instrumental in transforming Pepsi's portfolio of products by linking profitability with health and wellness concerns. PepsiCo's broad commitment to social responsibility includes comprehensive HIV/AIDS initiatives in South Africa, China, India, Russia, Thailand, and Mexico, and also a partnership with Starbucks to distribute Ethos clean water to children across the globe. I think some of you actually have that on your tables. I know I did over there. Oh, okay. The man without the suit jacket over there in the yellow tie is Jonathan Oppenheimer. He's managing director of De Beers. He's led efforts by De Beers to be at the vanguard of addressing major health problems, especially related to AIDS and TB. This work has now expanded into tackling broader aspects of access to health care through partnerships with governments, NGOs, and the World Health Organization. in the red is Dr. Carol Jacobs. She's the chairman of Barbados's National HIV-AIDS Commission and the chairman of the Global Fund to Fight HIV-AIDS, Malaria, and TB, known as the Big Three. The Global Fund attracts, manages, and disperses resources from donor governments, nonprofits, and businesses to fight the Big Three, including the recently announced Red Campaign, which may account for the color of your jacket, which is a groundbreaking partnership of five retail companies that dedicate a portion of their revenue streams to the Global Fund. And the man to my left who has a wonderful pair of shoes on. I don't know if you can see those, but he's making quite a fashion statement with these shoes. Is Peter Becker. He's the CEO of TNT International. It's one of the largest global packaging and postal distribution services. Last year, TNT donated $5 million to combat the alarming rate of HIV-AIDS spread along major transportation corridors by increasing awareness and prevention among truck drivers in Africa. And in your CGI packet, you may have seen a description of this program, the sort of blue, I was going to say buildings, but they're really converted cargo containers on pit stops along major truck routes in Africa, and we're going to hear more about that in just a minute. So this is our panel. Let the discussion begin. I want to begin with a question for all of you. What is it going to take to get companies and corporations, the business community, to recognize the value of a healthy workforce, to recognize the value of getting involved in promoting and maintaining global health, and then not just to recognize that, but to act on it? And Peter, I'm going to begin with you.
Well, I think what it's going to take is every company needs to realize that it has a responsibility on the globe. We at TNT, we've started a cooperation, a partnership with the World Food Program a couple of years ago. Transport companies like us are the biggest beneficiaries of globalization. Because at the end of the day, if you think about what is globalization, it is the ability to buy these beautiful shoes anywhere in the world. They're made in Italy, but you can buy them from China to North America to wherever. And companies like TNT get to ship those shoes around the world, and we make money that way. But if you are a beneficiary of globalization, you can't shut your eyes for some of the problems that are out there in the world. We started in a fight against hunger together with the World Food Program. But once you look into that fight, you immediately see the relationship it has with diseases like HIV/AIDS. Well, secondly, we're going to grow our business in places like India. Last week, we've announced an acquisition in India. We'll now operate 514 depots across the country. We're going to put more trucks on the road in India than were there before. But if you look at the HIV/AIDS problem again, a lot of the spreading of the disease comes from truckers. So if we want to be so big in this type of industry, we must also think about those type of problems. It's just part of the responsibility of a modern organization. And then, of course, next to it, it's your own interest. If you don't do it, your workforce gets ill and gets less productive, and your economics go down the drain. So it's two elements, the interest of your own company, but also your responsibility in the world as a whole.
Now, I've asked everyone to keep their comments brief because we're going to try to cover a lot of ground. But before we move to Carol, can you just give us a quick description for those who aren't aware of your program in Africa? Peter, before, I'm sorry, I just wanted to give
okay,
you
I'm
just
sorry,
a quick
me,
description of the pit stops.
I'll do it in 10 seconds. We have put up two sea containers in two locations in Malawi along the trucking corridors. There, the drivers, all drivers that come by, get educated, get tested, get basic primary health care, get condoms, and are on their way a lot safer than they were before. Mm-hmm. And we now have a plan to roll that out across the world.
Carol, what's it going to take to get the business community to step up and get involved in this?
I don't think it's going to be any one thing, Michelle. One of the things that are going to be 4E, like this one, where business people or healthcare professionals can come together, can share together, and really try to, because I think the answer is peer-to-peer response is peer-to-peer education. And I think this gives you a great opportunity for people to be leaders in the field. You talked about the Red Campaign, which is very innovative. The Global Fund, as everyone knows, is innovative. It's a new funding institution, and we really pride ourselves that we do things differently. We put great stock on it being a public-private partnership, and our board is very different. But you have both the public and the private sector, the NGOs, people living with the diseases, and private sector and private foundations at the one table making shared decisions, and we're very strong at performance-based. So all of these things really give initiatives to private sector and to private foundation to come out and to do creative new things. One quick comment I wanted to make coming out of today's sessions is that I think, as you said, it does have to be a healthy workforce, and we need to be looking at all the issues. Of course, our focus is HIV/AIDS, and for the Global Fund, tuberculosis and malaria. But all the other diseases that we've been looking at today and the other challenges are all part of a healthy workforce, and I think we do need to look at the whole thing within the global community.
Now, Jennifer, Carol was talking about partnerships. I want to ask the same question. What is it going to take to get the business community to become more involved, and what can the business community bring to the table that governments or perhaps NGOs lack?
That's a difficult one. Michelle, I think there are a number of things. One of the big issues is what business is about. And a critical aspect of what business is about is how long they're going to be in the space. I mean, I was trying to think of something to give people a sense of what it means to be permanent. De Beers is a 118-year-old company. We've got a family living in the Kimberley area in South Africa who've given over 700 years of service to our company in those 118 years. The nature of that is it's generational. So we have to look after that community. We have to provide health into that community. We have to provide education. It's not just health. And I think what we're hearing in the whole of the CGI process and the conversations and the plenaries and the conversations privately is that it's much more than just health. It's much more than just clean water. These things interconnect. And everything that we're doing is about interconnectivity. And so we've got, and the Global Business Coalition, which is part of the Global Fund, or rather helps fund the Global Fund, very kindly honored us with this incredible award last year where they recognized us as having a comprehensive HIV/AIDS program. That's great, but it's not the only part. You have to do the environmental, you have to do the educational, and you've got all these other components. So business can do that. The other thing that business can do is bring business discipline. And I mean, Peter and I were talking earlier about the World Food Program and the business discipline that TNT has brought to the World Food Program. We can bring that similar sort of business discipline. And just a silly statistic, and let's just try the room here. Who here would say that the cost of drugs in a comprehensive HIV/AIDS treatment program is 3% of the complete program cost? I hear a lot of silence. 3%. Just think about that for a second. How much media do you see about ART programs and everything else? I think you see 95% of the media on HIV/AIDS is about drugs. 88%, and I'll get back to the 12, 88% of the cost of our program, recognized by the GBC and others as comprehensive and effective, is on engagement prior to the point of treatment. And the treatment aspect is 12%. Only 3% or 25% or 20% of the treatment is drugs. That just blows your mind. So if those sorts of business analyses can be done, and then you can say, how do we reduce the cost of the 88%? Then you can begin to scale these things. The kind of program we run, totally unscalable to a national level. It's too expensive. But if we can begin to reduce that 88% to, say, a tenth of what it is now, then it could become scalable. Let's think about that. Let's engage on that. Let's make the difference there.
Now, Mike White, same question to you. What will it take to get businesses more involved in global health issues, but with a slightly different twist for you? And when companies do get involved, how do they go through the process of intervention selection? You can't do everything. So how do you decide where you're going to get involved?
I think that's a great question, Michelle. To me, for it to happen, you first of all have to have a recognition that there's a challenge. I think too many of us take our health for granted, particularly those of us who are fortunate enough to live in developed countries, and don't realize the important role it plays. So it starts with education. I think the second challenge is priorities. I mean, in any business environment, too often it's the urgent stuff that crowds out the critically important. And so you really, at the end of the day, I would say you need leaders who have a breadth of perspective, leaders who have a passion for the subject. In our case, we're a food and beverage company. And, you know, I touch on this subject in an even broader range than HIV/AIDS because for us it's also the proliferation of chronic diseases. I mean, it's changed in my lifetime. When I was a kid, what everybody worried about was malnutrition in the schools in the United States. We did a great job. Now we've got the opposite problem. We've got an epidemic of obesity. In fact, today there are more obese people in the world than there are malnourished. So to me, it starts with recognizing the issue. And then I think the fact is what we've found at PepsiCo is good health is good business. I mean, it's that simple. First of all, we're a people business. We have 80,000 people working internationally, over 100,000 and 30,000, 130,000 around the world. So we're a people-dependent business, number one. So the health of our employees is critically important to us. The second thing I would say is we've found with consumers it works, that when we can improve the health of our products, our healthiest products in North America are growing at three times the rate of our core traditional Pepsi and Lay's potato chips products. And even in emerging markets, you know, consumers aren't going to wait 50 years to wake up to the same challenges in terms of fats and sugars and so on and so forth. So, but it takes a focus, and in our case, because we can't do everything, we did focus pretty clearly on HIV/AIDS and how we dealt with that. Remember the Global Business Coalition on that. Second, how we deal with health. For instance, in Mexico and in Brazil, we have a huge school program. We call it Activados, and it runs 3 days a week. You have nutrition classes and exercise 20 minutes a day that we've partnered up with the Mexican government and the Brazilian government to do. And at the end of the day, we can't do it all ourselves. I think it is partnerships and alliances like that with both NGOs and governments that make a difference.
Now, Mike, this is a difficult question, but I'm sure many in the room are wondering why a representative from a company that sells, and you know where I'm going here, that sells snacks and soda, food products that often contribute to bad health outcomes, is participating in a panel about global health.
Yeah. No, I think it's probably kind of interesting to be up here, but I think it is because our chairman, Steve Reinemund, 4 or 5 years ago, saw this as a critically important priority for us. We created a Blue Ribbon Advisory Council of doctors from around the world, including the former head of the World Health Organization, including Dean Ornish. Janet Voogt from the World Heart Federation has been an advisor to us to try and better understand first the health impact of our products. And second, we recognized early that we needed to, first of all, improve the quality of our products and the healthfulness of our products. We've been changing our portfolio. Actually, we also have Tropicana, Gatorade, Aquafina water, Ethos water. So we've recognized that, you know, it is balance in nutrition that is the critical point. But if we don't get the message, we're not going to have consumers that are going to grow with us.
I want to ask you about risk and how you balance the investment against the potential risk, because you might not make a difference on your first outing. And if you try something and fail, I mean, you know, you're fortunate if you succeed on your first try, but most of us don't. And I imagine that's probably true for the corporate world. So if you take a misstep, if you don't, you know, solve the problem immediately, does it make it difficult to go to the table again and ask your board and ask your chairman for funding for yet another project? Jonathan?
Michelle, I think, again, for us, no is the simple answer, because we've got this view of this generational existence. Mm-hmm. And to try and illustrate that, we went on this health issue, we went on HIV/AIDS, and to think about it, what are we doing? We're certainly helping in the workplace. We've got people who would otherwise be dead still working for us. That's huge. It means less training. And we can kind of justify the existence of that process and the whole program on that basis. But financially, I can't justify it. I can't sit up and say this has added X on our bottom line. Mm-hmm. It doesn't work. It's kind of break even. But what I can say is I have now made sure that my workforce for the next generation are going to be sympathetic to Beers. They're going to want to work for us because we've helped their parents survive longer, given them an experience of having a parent. And right now, by our calculations, we've got something like 15,000 kids in sub-Saharan Africa who still have a parent because of what we're doing. Now, that's quite amazing. And if you can make that difference, if you can engage in the community in that way, you get that wonderful lock-in. And you get better productivity. Peter was talking about people who want to work for you. They'll go the extra mile. And we went through a really tough time last year. We had to shut a mine, and we had to downsize, and we let go a lot of people. And it was heartache. But everybody in the community said they could understand because they understood our numbers, they understood the issues, and they understood our commitment to the long-term viability of what we were doing. And if you can do that, you can charge hell with a bucket of water and you put it out.
Mike, I see you shaking your head. It sounds like the traditional equation for weighing these investments doesn't actually apply when you're looking at these kind of programs.
You know, I was just thinking, it's a fascinating question, and it's funny. I've never thought about risk in the context of these particular initiatives. I think about risk a lot in emerging markets and macro crashes and whatever else, but I think the risk of doing nothing is so much greater than the risk of trying to tackle some things. So, you know, whether it's in water or whether it's in HIV/AIDS, you know, we've got some initiatives that are close in and some that are further out. But, you know, so you balance your portfolio of bets with some sure things, with some longer-term things. But if you're not planting some seeds and taking some risks, then you're not working hard enough on it. And as I said, in our case, I mean, our business is food and beverage. The risk of doing nothing is so much greater for us.
Carol, go ahead, Peter. Yes.
I was going to say, we run our CSR like we run our business. So we measure the outcome. And when certain projects don't work or the benefits aren't what we had hoped to be, we will swap them for other ones which are better, just like we do in any normal business decision. It's not a straightforward financial calculation always. But you need to measure what you do when you start, the impact of it, and if it's not big enough, move on, try a better idea. That's how a business operates. And that's how, in my mind, the healthcare world in general, possibly, but certainly in some of these areas, needs a lot more discipline.
Now, I want to ask Peter and Carol a question. I want you to perhaps approach it from your different vantage points. In a world of limited resources, if a corporation gets involved and provides funding for a particular issue, I wonder if there's a worry that the local government might step back and say, well, that's taken care of, that there might be sort of an unintended outcome because De Beers or Pepsi or TNT is taking care of this, so I don't need to, I can redirect that revenue stream someplace else, perhaps where they need it. So is there a concern that when corporations step up, governments might stand down? Carol.
I think there is that concern, Michelle. I think donors always, in the private sector, always have, and donors at country level have that concern as well when you're making contributions to developing countries. But I think that more and more there's a consciousness within developing countries that it is their responsibility and that they initially have to make a commitment as well. But governments can't do it all. Most governments in developing countries with problems of HIV/AIDS, and I'm thinking particularly where the burden is highest, sub-Saharan Africa, Asia, which is an evolving epidemic, and Latin America and the Caribbean in particular, which is the region with the second highest prevalence of HIV/AIDS. All governments are contributing, but just to get ahead of it, the sort of resources that are needed, if the private sector doesn't join, you're just never going to be able to get ahead of the battle.
Peter?
No, and I don't see the risk that much. The way we participate in some of these ideas is by bringing skills, know-how to solutions. We're not storming in a country or a region and say, okay, we'll fix this problem and we'll take it over. We recognize that we need partnerships, sometimes with local governments, sometimes with NGOs, but only in partnerships can it work. I think the unique thing that business can bring is a business view, business decision making, and particularly if you talk to big companies like PepsiCo, De Beers, or TNT, a real global outlook. You know, we're building this wellness center concept with the mind to roll it out across the world. Because if you look into the health problems of the world, There are many, many bright ideas, but they're not integrated enough, they're not standardized enough, and we need global solutions which we start building. And that's something which, if you look in our businesses, we do every day. You know, like I said, we just operate 500 additional depots in a place like India. Well, that's not different than setting up a couple of hundred wellness centers around the world.
How did you come up with that concept, and how do you educate yourself to, in your case, determine that a wellness center at a border crossing, at a key border crossing, would work? In the case of De Beers, for instance, what kind of prevention programs might work? If we're going to provide treatment, which kind of drugs are we going to provide? How does a company actually educate itself?
Well, by making use of the best brains in the company, in our case. We have integrated our CSR programs throughout the company. So mailmen, postal people, our volunteers in countries, they come back with ideas. And in this particular idea came out of one of our leading leadership development programs. So 8 or 9 smart young guys from our company were sent to Malawi, come back with a good idea on how we can help Malawi become a better country. And they came, well, trucking is the real issue in HIV/AIDS, and wellness centers might be an idea. And then we say, okay, well, here's 150,000 euros. Try one and come tell us what it is. And that kind of got out of hand a bit.
The name Wellness Center, was that important? The name Wellness Center, was that important also that it had a rather positive aspect?
Yeah, of course, because the, like Jonathan said, the biggest part of the problem is actually not treating somebody who's ill. That's a big problem for the person who's affected by it. A much bigger challenge is how do you educate these, in this case, guys, the mobile workers. And if you go there with a very negative, "Oh, this is when you're very ill, you come here," they certainly won't go in. So Wellness Center is kind of a better name.
One of the things that I have learned in attending some of the sessions is that businesses have sometimes found, I've heard this in one of the plenaries yesterday, I heard it in the session that I attended yesterday, that businesses sometimes find that they're not welcomed with open arms, that sometimes countries are reluctant to work with businesses, sometimes reluctant to work with NGOs for various reasons. Sometimes it's they're wary because of a bad experience. So, Carol, it seems like in your position that you could play the role of ambassador. How do you help a company sort of find its way in that situation?
I don't see my role as helping a company to find its way, basically. Let me start by saying that. We have a private sector and a private foundation seat on the Global Fund Board, and the Global Business Council is a focal point for the private sector seat, and they really pull their constituency together. However, what I want to say is that there is no one way that private sector can contribute. They can do prevention campaigns, they can do treatment, they can do in-kind contributions, they can do pro bono contributions, they can do straight cash contributions, they can do co-investment at country level. It really is almost limitless the way in which private sector can get engaged. And certainly at the board at the Global Fund, we have a wonderful working relationship between the entities that sit on our board. So in a lot of ways, it's the perfect melting point and sort of takeoff point for initiatives that involve governments and private sector.
Now, the Global Fund awarded De Beers a significant award, and it seemed like it was the Global Business Council, awarded De Beers, and it seemed like when you talked about it that you were quite proud of that. I wonder if that is in those kinds of things are important. When young people join a company, they have certain aspirations. How do you make sure that this kind of work is one of their aspirations, that they're not just interested in getting into the corner office, into upper management, but that they aspire to do these kinds of things, to do good things, and perhaps find their better selves in doing so?
Sure, I think what you're describing is really interesting, because what we've found is salary isn't everything in our business. Sometimes in recruiting, it seems to be up near the top, but the moment you get into this, it's really right down the bottom, and it's job satisfaction. And I'll give you a parallel non-health example of this. We're currently exploring, actually, funnily enough, with President Kikwete in Tanzania, trying to get into helping where we're totally uninvolved, what I would call the subsistence small-scale mining communities in Tanzania, focused on diamonds. And there, the NGOs think that business is the devil. And we've had some engagements in that domain which have been revolutionary. We've gone in and we've started doing things, and the NGOs have gone, hang on, you're doing our job for us. They're saying, no, we're not. We're actually doing what's good business practice for us, because if we can create a sustainable community to operate in, we'll have better systems, we won't have people stealing our diamonds, the legal environment will be better, you name it. Health will be better, because now we don't have this tension, the various things, the community is richer, it's all interlinked. And in doing that, we can really begin to do some really exciting stuff. And what's really neat is the NGOs are coming on board. We're in the process of a diagnostic phase right now in Tanzania, and the two sort of consultancy NGOs that are involved said they waited 20 years to see a program like this. Now why? Because business has brought business discipline. We have a very clear intent, and we can drive towards that just as we've done in the health area. And that's really exciting and neat. But again, it's this comprehensive program. It's this integrated whole.
Now, we have just seconds left, and it's not fair for me to do this, Carol, I know, but there's just one last question I have to ask you to be oh so quick about it. We have seen in the last few weeks, actually last few days, a new strain of a drug-resistant form of TB surface in South Africa. And I know you only have seconds, but I'm wondering if there is a particular role for the business community to play, and is it possible for them to play a role in reacting to something quickly, to an epidemic, a potential epidemic like this, quickly?
I think, of course, there is. But it has to be, business can't just go, obviously that's a medical research issue, so that they have to do it in partnership, obviously. But half of the challenge is that people want to do things and you don't have the funding to do it. And that applies to research when it comes to drugs, it applies to providing drugs, it applies to behavior change campaigns, to changing behaviors. You always need, the bottom line is the money, and where are you going to get it? So the partnerships between business and NGOs or governments are critical.
Good, good. Well, our time is up for this section, or this portion of our discussion. Daniel's going to come back up again, and he's going to present the question for all of you to work on in your working groups.
Good. Thanks very much. So we've seen across the different sessions in this working group, and especially in this session, a number of excellent examples of businesses and corporations that are committing themselves to taking action to address health-related issues. Yet we also know that there are many businesses that are not involved, or perhaps not as involved as they might be. So there does represent a huge potential that could potentially be tapped into to increase the level of resources that are available to address some of these very serious issues. So the question that we would like you to address, and this is the last question in our working group, is a two-part question. First of all, where does business responsibility start and end as it relates to dealing with these global health issues? And then related to that, how can we get more businesses to get involved if they're not already involved, or for those businesses that are involved to expand their level of involvement? Now, last time around, we have fewer numbers than we did last time around, and we are also continuing to have great table conversations. So I want to encourage you again to, if you are a small table of only three or four, to find another table to merge with to get more folks involved, more energy at the tables. Have a great conversation, and we'll be back up here in 25 minutes. Thank you.
Rejoining us on the stage, we encourage everyone to move to the front tables for our final few minutes.
I needed it. Oh, you need to wake up.
Well, we're going to continue with the next phase of our discussion, and I do think, if you don't mind, for those of you, we have seen, some of us have left, and those of us who are with us, thank you for hanging in there. I think you're going to find that it was worth your while in the next portion of this discussion. And if you want, please move forward to sort of come in a little bit closer, and it'll feel much more like an intimate discussion, perhaps among friends. We're now going to hear some of the questions from the audience, and I like this portion because they generally have
very sharp observations and often very sharp questions. So I'm going to begin with Jonathan. How do companies link or apply their core competencies, what they do best, to addressing global health issues?
That's Michelle, I mean, who asked that question?
If you want to claim it, you can raise your hand.
That was a damn good question. I think our experience, and I'm not sure about others, I know if I was in Peter's business, it would be relatively easy. But our core skills are in ability to manage systems. What we do is we move dirt out of a hole through a plant and we extract tiny, tiny, tiny amounts of stuff out of that dirt, and we do it pretty expertly. And to do that, we have to be reasonably good at logistics. And so part of it is that, but part of it is also understanding what keeps the communities going. And it's that, you heard me all talk about permanence and this sort of generational view. We've had out the box a view of creating something which is sustainable in the long term. And we've built the skills to make that sustainability, and that's what we're leveraging into the health space. So I think that would be my theme, is hang in there and use the skills that you have. If you don't have them, go and get the experts. Go and find a Peter to do the logistics if you don't have somebody in-house, just as the World Food Program did.
Hmm. Mike?
I think it's a great question, Carol. In our case, you know, we felt that we have a unique competence in communication and marketing to teens. And if you think about a lot of these, whether it's HIV/AIDS, Carol and I were talking about, in changing behaviors, or whether it's changing behavior in terms of your eating habits, we'd like to think that the ability to market, to communicate, can be part of the solution, not just part of the problem. And so, you know, in terms of motivating even internally, the ability to kind of use words and pictures to really touch people, to get them to change their behavior, I think is something that we do uniquely well. And therefore, it's come naturally to us to try and use that skill in addition to our distribution systems in trying to really make a difference here.
Carol, why has business investment in the Global Fund been relatively modest up to this point, and what do you do to change that?
I think because traditionally governments have taken responsibility for programs, but let me be fair to the private sector and that there has been engagement at the levels that are harder to measure, and we are actually now at a stage where I believe the Gates Foundation is going to help us measure some of these contributions. In other words, the Gates Foundation.
And the example Melinda of Gates that, Foundation. Investments that are hard to measure.
The co-investment, what a private sector is doing at country level, what their in-kind contribution, their services that they're giving and not billing us for. So that there are a lot of still unmeasured contributions. But about 6 weeks ago, we had this magnificent major donation from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation of $500 million. And that's a great marker for us, for the private sector and private foundations. But we need more of those, and we need more engagement.
Yeah, a lot of clams. Yeah. Would businesses contribute to the Global Fund if they were acknowledged more? Would an attaboy or an attagirl
get the pump going? That's some of it. I mean, everyone wants to be recognized. But also sometimes I think businesses in general may not be aware of the avenues to contribute, and the fact that there is a very strong emphasis on the private sector being a real part of this partnership. And I think now that the Global Business Council is a focal point, it's engaging private sector more and more.
Peter, I think this is a very interesting question, observation from the audience. They would like to know whether businesses that are active, or would you say that businesses that are active in global health issues do so primarily because of a commitment of the CIO? Does it start in the head office? And if so, how sustainable are those initiatives once that executive moves on?
I think it is a good sign when it starts in the head or the office of the CEO, particularly when, as a business, you're new to it. you actually need support from the top to find your way. If you're a smart CEO, though, your first priority will be to roll it out as deep into your company as you can, precisely to prevent the problem that you highlight. We've started a partnership with the World Food Program now nearly 5 years ago, and in the initial period, everybody said, well, once Bakker leaves the office, then that will die, and that's almost impossible, because once you, as a company, claim, which TNT has done, that we will join the World Food Program in the fight against hunger, you can't really stop that fight until hunger is solved, and that's certainly not when I'm going to lose my job, because that, the efforts, life of a CEO these days is not going to be long enough. So you need to make sure that in your organization, people are now truly motivated and involved and engaged in that process. I'll give you the strongest example that works, and it comes from our own experience. There's two messages in business life that are pretty tough to take. The first one is, you are fired. That's a nasty message, occasionally. It depends a little bit on the arrangements you have, but for the average person, can be pretty nasty.
Parachuters.
The second nastiest message you can get in business life is, we are selling your division or your unit or whatever. That's also, you are no longer part of my family, out of here. We have given that message recently to 35,000 of our employees. We've sold a division. The management of that division, after their first week of shock, came back to us and said, but one thing, we want to remain partners of the World Food Program. So we had the first information memorandum in the world out there, which talked about this partnership. We've sold it to private equity, and they've now agreed to continue to be part of our program. So I don't think it's any more dependent on me or a few people. It's really deep into it.
Pepsi has trumpeted, in small ways, the work that they're doing in this country to fight obesity. And in even smaller ways, at least that are evident in this country, perhaps you're doing more overseas. What are the PR benefits to doing this kind of work? And to what issue, what kind of fine line do you walk in tooting your own horn, but also making sure that you get credit for this because you deserve the credit, but also because you want to perhaps encourage other businesses to get involved in this kind of thing?
Why? Again, I don't think we think that much about it as a PR exercise, to be honest, Michelle. It what we want to make sure is that we convey to any external constituencies an openness and a constructive approach to dialogue, because we can learn some things. I mean, let's face it, we weren't on this program 10 years ago. And I think we've learned some things as we've engaged with different NGOs, whether it's the Global Business Coalition on HIV/AIDS or whether it's the Environmental Resource Institute in India on water or others. And I think it's as much or more making sure people see a constructive and open attitude in terms of how you engage in it. I think to your other question on the CEO's role, I think the CEO plays a critical role, but I have to tell you, if this stuff doesn't take root at the grassroots level, I mean, we've got two nurses in South Africa in our snacks plants there that personally went to every one of our 3,000 employees there to encourage them to get voluntarily tested. And, you know, we've recognized them in New York recently, but, you know, it's the power I found in international. I do international for my life, and, you know, I can send stuff out from New York. I got news for you. The rest of the world doesn't necessarily always follow what I tell them to do. You're much more effective if you can set the tone, if you can set the goal, and then you can empower people to adapt it, tailor it, be culturally sensitive to different cultures in the way you do it in tackling the obesity challenge, because eating habits are different outside the U.S. than in the U.S.
Now, I'm going to follow up on this question. I know I'm supposed to be sticking to the questions from the audience, but I think this does beg a follow-up and sort of the corollary. And I'm asking you in the abstract, because I'm not sure this has actually happened at PepsiCo, but what if the CEO does leave and is replaced by someone who doesn't have the same kind of commitment in this and says, you know, I'm not sure that this is worth the investment. I'd like to spend the money in other ways. How do you make sure that
Well, that's a great question for me, Michelle, because our CEO just decided to retire and was replaced with a woman, Indra Nui, who is outstanding, and Indra happens to be totally committed to the same priorities in terms of health and wellness as Steve is. But what if she wasn't?
Well, I suppose that's
why I think you've got to get the commitment at the grassroots level. My team in South Africa, you know, and we started this before it actually was done bottoms up in that case rather than top down, because we saw it as an issue in South Africa 4 years ago. Now we're taking it to other countries. But I think that's why you've got to get people engaged, and then whether someone changes at the top doesn't matter, because people recognize it's a priority.
Jonathan, we've talked about trust. How can businesses feel confident that multilateral organizations or NGOs that they partner with have effective channels for funding and a strong enough organizational system?
That's a great question. We've got exactly that dilemma on our hands right now. We have a medical facility at one of our mines which is providing care into the community. And the care into the community is being picked up with a program using PEPFAR money. And it's wonderful. It's brilliant. It's doing the most amazing things. Our fear is what happens after PEPFAR. Who's responsible for the continuation of that care? And it's a real dilemma. And in many respects, our first preference is to move those kinds of relationships into government-based relationships, because the one thing that we know is we want to be permanent. Governments are permanent. They can't leave the country in which they govern. So if we can create a relationship, which is kind of happening with the Northern Cape, we've got this really interesting dynamic and a relationship building with the Northern Cape administration, which is leading to permanence and is leading to capacity to do that. And so we are addressing those issues. And you just have to work them through. There's no simple sort of snap the fingers answer. And the conversations are really interesting because they start with this level of distrust. NGOs don't like business. Business doesn't like government. Government doesn't like everybody else. And as you start unpacking that and you start actually identifying the goal, you find it's the same goal. And when you found it's the same goal, then you can work together to achieve that goal. And then all of a sudden, hey, we get phone calls from the local Minister of Health in the Northern Cape, we call the MEC for Health. She rings up our doctors and asks if they can do these things. And we have open access to her and the NGO community suddenly playing ball. And it's the same in the other areas. I mean, whether it's only in health, it's not only in health. It's the same in the environment. It's the same in the community initiatives that we have. We've got this incredible program called Isibindi. Isibindi means courage. And one of the greatest challenges, and I'm sorry I'm going to take a little bit of time because you have to hear this. One of the greatest challenges in South Africa is orphans and vulnerable children, OVCs. And South Africa has institutional capability to handle, I think, 100,000 orphans right now. We have 1 million. And so it's not a solution to institutionalize orphans. But at the same time, if you don't want to institutionalize orphans, what do you do? And so in partnership with the National Child Care Workers Association of South Africa, a government-accredited body, we're helping them train in child care workers in the community who help these child-headed households in the community continue to exist. So the kids can go to school, but they are able to access government grants. And the government is supporting that. And the tripartite cooperation in this is just, it's mind-boggling. When you go to this, you go in. I went on a site visit to Isibindi 2 weeks ago in Kimberley, in one of the townships called Khalishiwe, and going and visiting the people on the ground, the incredible, and I mean incredible hope that it creates is just amazing, and I think it was all captured for me. We ended up at this girl. She's 17 years old. She's responsible for a family of four. She got special permission to be out of school that day to meet us as one of the principal sponsors that is helping her and her childcare worker. And the childcare worker was there. She was there. Her brothers who were at school were still at school. And one of the people with me turned to her and said, why
what do you want to do when you grow up? And she turned around and she said, I want to be a childcare worker. And she just so embraced, and she had a life because of the system. And South Africa can have a life because of that system. And if you can create that kind of cooperation, then you've got a chance. If you can't, we might as well pack up now. Great party, guys. Thanks a lot. Let's leave. Because if you can't create that kind of partnership, you cannot succeed in addressing these huge problems faced this world.
Okay, now Chris is going to come back up, Chris Jennings. And they've had time to look at some of the work that you've done, all of the work, actually, even at your tables, and they're going to present, he is going to present some themes and some of the gems that have emerged from your discussions.
Thank you. I don't want to stand in front of you. First of all, that was really moving, Jonathan. Thank you. I have to say that the size of the room has not diminished the quality of the product. So I'll just go straight into the first points, into the themes, because I want to quickly let a few minutes allow you to respond. One is companies should start with the health of their employees. You got to go further probably, but start with your employees. Secondly, companies need an economic rationale for their funding of global health issues, frequently to get corporate and board support. Commitment to communities extends to responsibility for communities of suppliers, which is to say that it's not just your direct employees, it's your suppliers as well, and goes beyond, I'm sure, as I know that, for example, De Beers has been doing in many cases. Successful initiatives, the next slide, result when core business mission and public health are closely aligned. You need to take care of business, you need to take care of your expertise, and when you do, you can do more. And positive or negative PR can be a motivator for corporate involvement, and it's not necessarily bad. Okay, the nuggets. The nuggets, NGOs and governments benefit from using business expertise for administration of their programs. It's really important to recognize huge skills do exist and should be integrated. Corporations that lead partnerships of businesses, NGOs, and governments can sometimes really bring credibility to those partnerships. Consumers should demand more social responsibilities from the companies that they patronize. That can make a difference too, and that can be positive or negative. Multinationals can increase the impact. I'm so sorry. WHO needs to get real was a message. WHO needs to get real. And as a business has a role to play, business is not necessarily bad. They are not the enemy here. And lastly, of course, which was, of course, appropriate to this panel, there should be more companies like De Beers, Pepsi, and TNT, any takers. For that, I'll conclude. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chris. And I want to start with that last point. Encouraging more companies to do this. I mean, certainly when you hear testimonials like yours, Jonathan, and you talk about, you know, what you see, and you're changing people's lives, and, you know, those small stories, those stories that don't necessarily, you're not going to find in the annual report. Maybe in these last few moments, you can tell us, you can make the case why other companies should follow in your footsteps. Carol, in your case, make the case why other companies should follow in their footsteps from your perspective. And if you can do that with sort of a personal observation, something that you can share from your experience that may motivate someone in this room, a story that perhaps can be relayed and will have an almost anaerobic effect and find itself into a corporate boardroom someplace else. I'm going to begin with you, Peter.
On the spot, right? I think I cannot think of anything inside of TNT that has changed the culture, the way our CSR programs, our partnership with the World Food Program has changed it. We're a company which has been built on the basis of 47 different acquisitions. This is something that glues us all together. We get people working for us from companies which in the past would never have thought about joining transport companies like ours, simply because we do this type of programs and we take our responsibility serious. If you go to the places where our people, because I can tell stories like Jonathan did, forklift truck drivers who saved thousands of people in Banda Aceh simply by being there as part of a volunteer program. It's just an amazing energy that you unlock inside your company. You need to be very careful in the way you PR that. But if you do good, people will talk about you and your reputation will improve. So, you know, come out and help. There are so many problems in the world. There is no better form of organization in the world than a company is. And if you guys can bring the passion like Jonathan has it, then, you know, companies are really going to be a main contributor to solving the problems that we face.
Carol, you've got an incredible platform and an interesting audience. Make the case.
Thank you, Michelle. I'll give it a good shot. Yes, the Global Fund has burst on the scene, so to speak, in the last 4 years and really changed the whole scenario as far as funding for AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria at a global level. It really ramped that up. However, we are still looking at what is now roughly $1 billion a year as we do a round of funding each year, and to sustain the ongoing grants, another billion. So we're really needing like $2 billion. We are, for the grants that are currently being applied for, we still have a little shortfall for this year. And we know that the need is there. If we're going to get on top of these diseases, if we're going to eradicate them, we have to maintain that funding. And I think that makes the case. That, based on what these gentlemen have spoken about, I think that makes the case as effectively as I can.
Jonathan, we've heard a testimonial, but if you could briefly make the case why others should follow your lead.
I think two things. One is having a culture which believes that it's going to be there for the long term. If you can create that in a company, you get incredible, extraordinary performance. And for me, a kind of a visual, I can remember as a youngster going and sitting at my grandfather's knee and meeting all sorts of people. And what is so amazing for me is meeting certain people, and in the organization today, seeing those same people, and yet it's their children. And that sense of continuum, that sense of a linear line that extends through time, and the ability to make a difference for people over the long term. The Clutie family, 700 years of service for De Beers. That is just mind-boggling. And they have a commitment to and a desire to work for De Beers. Makes all the difference. And it makes my job worthwhile. It makes it easy to come and talk to you. And I think Peter said something really important. PRing this is not an option. You don't do that. You do what's right on the ground, and it must speak for itself. If you start spinning it, you risk everything. It's desperate. And it's a difficult thing because you want to be liked. You want to tell people the great stories, but you don't want to PR it. You don't want to spin it.
Mike, you have the last word.
Yeah. First of all, I go back to the first point I made, which is I think global health is good business. Our consumers want it, and we're getting great sales from them when we do it. But way before any of us are business people or governments or NGOs, we're human beings. I'm a father, I'm a son, I'm a husband. And I'm a human. And to see the way we motivate our own people when you start these initiatives. We started when the tsunami hit in Asia. Yeah, I gave some money. Big deal. I had my entire workforce in India, people who make, $2,000 a year. They gave up a full day's pay in order to be able to contribute water and other needs there, and to see the motivation, the morale that creates in your organization. If you're an international organization, we did the same thing in Lebanon. We just collected $300,000 from our employees in the Middle East. And again, these are people who aren't paid lots of money like I am. And to see the motivation and the sense of family that creates in a business, the pride in attracting the best people who want to work for us, at the end of the day, we are an institution made up of people, and we're going to win in the marketplace provided we continue to attract people who want to be there because they understand that it's more than making a dollar.
Mike White with PepsiCo, Jonathan Oppenheimer with De Beers, Carol Jacobs with the Commission with the Global Fund to Fight HIV, AIDS, Malaria, and TB, and Peter Becker with TNT International. Thank you very much. This concludes our conversation, but I hope very much that these conversations in this room will continue for days and months to come. Thank you very much.